Hello, hello, everyone, on this fine Thursday morning. I personally have a few sick children in my house, and I am biding my time because I think it is coming for me. So we are here with the 99 Dev Problems show. I am excited to talk with David this morning. David, I would love if you could introduce yourself.
Absolutely. My name is David Beal. I live in Chicago, Illinois. I'm originally from Virginia, did a nice stint in New York City, which is kind of where I kicked off my career. And I've been a lot of things. I've been a software engineer, a DevOps engineer, a sales engineer, and right now I'm a site reliability engineer at a company called Payneer Me.
Ooh, gosh, I have like so many things I want to pry into that. Like I did some sales engineering for a while. So let's like come back to that because I want to talk about that role because it's not a role that gets talked about a lot. So yeah. I think it'd be cool to compare your roles. As it relates to your developer education, whether that be sort of official or self-taught, can you share with folks how you got into having the technical chops that you have today?
I can. I'm 100% self-taught. Had a pretty rough childhood, and things really fell apart my senior year of high school. I ended up living in my car, you know, delivering pizzas, just sort of surviving. And so I ended up not actually finishing. I went to college a couple times, community college stints, but usually I just get the student loan money and like buy a van and go on tour with my band. Yeah. And so, you know, that being said, I was a musician. I still am. And I toured a lot through my like late teens and 20s, started out working in restaurants, and, eventually a restaurant that I was working at needed a website, like, you know, menu, all that sort of stuff. And so, that was one of the first things that I ever did. I had built like, you know, skateboarding websites and MySpace themes. And, you know, I knew my way around like HTML, CSS. I'd done some PHP. And then, you know, in the late 90s, I was like a MIRC and then, you know, got into installing Slackware on my computer and playing around with Python and stuff like that. But my home life was so chaotic that I really didn't get to like, you know, develop that or be like, ooh, I could go to school and like learn this and like have a job and stuff like that. It was more just like, I have to survive and kind of got caught in a whirlwind. So I really didn't like get my career kicking until, you know, like 2011, 2012. I had done some contract work. I worked in computer stores, did like all this stuff. And then I'd like build websites on the side, like taught myself Ruby on Rails, like just sort of random stuff like that. And then I got my first job as a contractor. And just doing like kind of a data center refresh. And then I worked for another company doing like kind of server patching and automation and still writing code on the side. And then in 2014, life just sort of imploded in like a sort of beautiful way. And I moved to New York and my friend had a studio apartment on 34th and Park. I slept on his futon for 6 weeks. It took me 3 weeks to get my first job. And I just started working at New York startups. I didn't know what a DevOps engineer was. I didn't know what AWS was. I mean, kind of. But I moved there and I just figured it out. I went to recruiters and looked at job descriptions and learned the tech. And then I got my first job and I had no idea what I was doing. And You've been there. And I would just stay up all night and figure it out and post on Stack Overflow and Reddit and anywhere else I possibly could and figure out the answers. The good news is that, you know, in the early days of DevOps, no one really knew what they were doing.
True that.
And yeah, just kind of slowly but surely built up a skill set. And, you know, thankfully it's, you know, carrying on and I'm still gainfully employed and supporting my family and thinking about, you know, what's next, where I go from here.
I loved hearing your story. There is a lot. And obviously in the pre-show, you and I got to take 15 minutes and like really deeply get to know each other, which was really, really great to even sort of just speak about that, right? Like very similar childhoods that we talked about, very similar sort of adulthoods and just having to figure things out. Yesterday, Aaron Francis mentioned having grit and just go do the thing and really talking about just, it doesn't matter if you don't know what you're doing, write about it, go do it. Eventually things will come together. And it sounds like your story is like very much an exemplary case of that, where you had a lot of stuff going on, life and otherwise, and you figured out exactly sort of that niche. And I think, you know, as it relates on my side, very similar. I was also in restaurants, did bartending. Then instead of going the route of sort of musician, I wasn't that cool. I went into restaurant management. And so I spent a great deal of time over in restaurant management. So then that slowly eked into my tech career as well. So that was very cool to hear about. So of the different, sorry, if you have a follow-up, go ahead.
Go ahead.
To interrupt you. Yeah. I was going to ask you of the different opportunities and roles that you had, like, do you have a favorite? Even though I think sometimes we get further and we're like, oh, we're better now, but I don't know. Some of my early jobs were really fun and more straightforward and just, there was a lot more learning. So I'm curious if you had sort of a favorite thing throughout that career.
There's a couple. So I worked at a company called Red Owl Analytics, and it was cool because I met the CTO through sort of one of my earliest mentors in tech. This guy named Greg Cannon, awesome guy. Met him on a skateboarding Usenet group.
That's so
cool. He was a software engineer. Gave me my first like Linux shell account that I could SSH into and like host my website and all that sort of stuff. And so I met Paul, the CTO, through Greg. And immediately I was just thrown on site at Blackstone, the hedge fund. And I'm And I'm I'm about a year into living in New York, but I'm from a small town in Virginia. I'm uneducated. I'm making it up as I go along. I'm like literally like, you know, trying to just like remember how people talked in like the West Wing and like shows with smart people and be like, I'm going to use those words. And man, it was not graceful. I was uncomfortable, but I was there. I was on site for 3 months, like there till 3 a.m, just like snowflaking this sort of MapReduce data aggregation application that we built. And, you know, really just trial by fire, had to learn so much so fast. And without the sort of humiliation of being like on site surrounded by all these, you know, incredibly intellectually superior people, I don't think I could have done it. So that's a favorite one. It sucked. Like I was pretty unhappy and it was tough, but like looking back, it's like, you know, I'm a big fan of David Goggins, and he talks about your hurt locker and like how you got to like wake up every day and like feel that pain sometimes. And you know, it probably didn't suck any more than getting a computer science degree at like a top level university. You know, I'm sure that, you know, finishing up a master's in computer science at MIT is probably equally or more so uncomfortable to the experience I had. So I often think about those early jobs as my education. You know, like I wasn't really qualified. They needed bodies. I was cheap. And I kind of knew what I was doing. I knew what I was doing enough to be effective, and I could fake the rest. And, so that was a big one. I started getting some better jobs. You know, I worked at a skincare and, makeup company called Glossier that kind of boomed, made a lot of great connections there. You know, got my current job because of connections from that job.
That's amazing. Networking is king.
I worked at Etsy, which, you know,
that's cool.
They were huge in DevOps and one of the, you know, the architects of like the original system that kind of became the model for like a successful DevOps shop. I got there a little after that. You know, I got there in some growing pains, like regime changes, moving from a commitment to bare metal into Google Cloud. But I did some good work and I learned a lot and like, you know, so those are huge. And then the last one I'll mention, and this is circling back to sales engineering, I worked at a company called Armory. So I had a pretty good amount of experience with Spinnaker, which was a continuous delivery tool first built by Netflix. And so when I, back in 2022, I was really burnt out, like working in the pandemic as a developer, DevOps engineer, especially like fairly extroverted one. It's pretty isolating. So I talked to a friend and he was like, you should just try being a sales engineer. You'll make more money. It's a more socially stimulating job and you can use your experience, just like work for a DevOps company. So I worked for Armory and had a great leader, a guy named Paul. He's just a legend in sales engineering. And learned so much. It was kind of another Red Owl type experience where I was just thrown in. I was on a plane demoing in person to, you know, a huge airline within 2-3 weeks of starting the job, which, you know, is pretty crazy. And so I've kind of just always loved those. I like those jobs where it's just like, you know, here's a laptop, here's root access to everything. Everything's broken.
Go break stuff.
I wish you the best of luck and I won't notice anything you do.
Oh my gosh. Those are good, very good lessons there. No. Very much related. I mean, you said a lot of really, really interesting things, but relating to the sales engineer side of things and sort of your experience being thrown into like Blackstone, I can relate to that very much. And you probably related to when you were in New York City. It was like, once you get thrown into sort of that Silicon Valley, or like the, in New York City's case, the NYC sort of, you know, whatever
Silicon
it's called,
Alley.
Right? Yes,
Silicon
I
Alley.
Love that.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Silicon Alley, let's call it that. Things are different. I remember working at a company that was in open source. I would have never guessed that I would have had this experience, but we went out for dinner because we were doing a very like sales engineering / developer advocate type of a an event, essentially. And that's the role I was playing. And I ended up like sitting at a dinner where it was like a 500 person dinner. And I was just so uncomfortable. There was like so many pieces of silverware that I had no idea what they were for and where they were supposed to go and when I was supposed to use them. And so I can relate to that also of like, you just, when you're thrown into those scenarios of like almost chaos, whether it be technically, socially, or whatever, I feel like those are the opportunities where you're like, okay, we're faking it till we make it.
Yeah.
And when you do make it or you don't make it, there's a lot that comes out of that you learn that you can take into that next experience, which sounds very much like how your career has been.
Yeah. And I think that's a testament to something that I've been really like coming to terms with lately. I'm not an incredibly technical person. I was never great at math. I was never great at, you know, but and I am because I'm an artist, and the way that I express myself as an artist is often very technically. When I was a kid, like I would take things apart, not because I cared so much about how they worked. It's because I was like, this VCR would look way better if the internals were visible. Like it was it was like a,
yeah.
And I realized that like my greatest piece of art that I've ever built up to this point is my career. It's performance art. 100% performance art. Like I don't have the formal background. I grew up, my father did not grow up with electricity. He grew up Mennonite.
Very different.
Like I have hopped like a big jump here. And so the only way that I can do this is truly, and it's not deceptive. It's just, I am learning how to, I learned how to be an engineer from a performance standpoint. Like I learned the words, the cadence, the tools. Part of that is being able to write code. But for me, it's like, it's more like an expression, you know, like, okay, I can just do this. Like, and that's to me, the ultimate freedom of like being a creative person, being an artist is just like, I can just create this piece of art. And for me, it's like my career. So I think of the sales engineering part, and I'm actually fresh back from that. So I was a sales engineer for about 2 years, and I'm almost 3 months into my current job.
And, oh wow, so very fresh.
Yeah, yeah. So this is my first job back. I am a much better engineer, and I appreciate building more than I ever have, because when you're selling, you're not building. When you're selling, you can do everything right and still lose, because.
Yep.
You know, they were always just going to buy the other thing, but their boss said, no, you have to do 2 POCs or I can't approve the purchase. And I can't do that. Like for me, like when I'm building, and I think that's where the artist mindset comes in. You know, if I'm putting all this effort into this painting, I want to be able to stand back and look at it. And, and that's the beauty of, you know, building infrastructure, building products, building code, building anything. So, you know, I enjoyed it and I'm glad that I did it. I'm glad that I know that I can do it. It's made me a better communicator.
But
it's also made me really kind of challenge challenged my values a lot. I'm just selling at this point in my life does not align with my values. Building does. So.
Yeah. Yep. Well, that's really interesting. So accurate on the side of no longer building. You're building demos, you're building sort of maybe integration pieces. You're like, you know, trying to present your product in the right way, but it is not the building that, you know, you and I or any really other sort of true-blooded developer enjoys doing. Sometimes a good demo would get me excited because I'd build something or do some fun new use case with it, but that didn't last as long as, like you said, when you can take a step back and like look at the full picture of everything that you've built and how that contributes to everything else.
Yeah. And it's speculative. You're building all these things in hopes that it closes the deal instead of we're building all of these things for this awesome, you know, API or whatever product that we're selling. And so it just felt really ephemeral. And, but you know, I can't overstate how helpful it was. And like the people that I met, and I'll say this to you, the only true currency in your career, and I don't care what industry you're in, are the people that you meet and the relationships that you build. And, and I learned that, or it was further, you know, affirmed to me in my time in sales. And I'm definitely flush with relationships coming out of that. And so, you know, no regrets. It's great. Maybe I'll do it again one day. Who knows? Probably not. I think there's other things that I would like to do if I were going to do something else in tech. But I'm glad this is a part of the story.
Yeah. See, I relate very much to that. I think what a good hybrid, and this is sort of a good conversation, you know, that to kind of dive into, but when I was playing that sales engineering role, and when I have, honestly, I've played it like my entire career really, because I am also extroverted, even though if people are not technical or intelligent, I do get drained. And so I'm sort of like, I'm an extrovert with smart people, but I'm an introvert with the rest of the world. That's what I think. But I love to talk to people who are technical and I like to get out there. And so I think that the sales engineering role can very much feel like that grind. But in my opportunities, I've had a developer advocacy sort of layer over top of them. So if I built like a sales demo, I was usually presenting a similar type of talk, not about, hey, look at my product, but like, oh, hey, look at a potential solution for a technical problem that you're spinning your wheels on. And I feel like that gave me a lot of value from that, because then you get the feedback from developers. They're like, oh my gosh, this was so great. I'm going to go take this code sample, or like, you really helped me. And I think that helps sort of supplement maybe what you were missing potentially in your sales engineering role.
Yeah. And, you know, I think as a sales engineer, you're often kind of thrown into a lot of different roles, and you're oftentimes like, it will really change how you feel about salespeople, you know, account executives. They can be your best friend and just love you and think you're the most genius person in the world. And then, you know, the second that their technical or economic buyer rolls their eyes, you know, you're damaged goods, and you're the reason the sale blew up. And, you know, there's just a lot there. There's a lot. It makes me wonder, like, do people really need to be making like $400,000 or $500,000 a year as a middleman to sell, you know, SaaS applications to developers? Like maybe we could worry a little bit less about AI replacing developer jobs if we weren't like sending a bunch of AEs to President's Club every year. I don't know. Like, maybe we could rebalance the economics of tech a little bit, and the people who build the products could make more money than the people who sell them. And you know,
that'd
we're getting
be a
into
great world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we're getting into, you know, a little bit of politics and economics and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's interesting, you know, it's interesting knowing how the sausage is made and then also knowing how it's sold.
Yeah.
And maybe that's more than people need to know if they want to just have a job and be happy and, you know, live life. But for me, I feel like as a developer now, I know exactly, and I call myself a developer. I'm a site reliability engineer, whatever. I write a lot of YAML, but I, you know,
you're a developer.
I write Terraform. I write whatever. I write a lot of Python, like, but it's made me understand my value more. It's made me understand like like how, what my impact is. And something that I've been thinking about a lot is how we're not really paid for our skills. Like anybody mm-hmm. can have skills. We're paid for our enthusiasm and we're paid for our curiosity and we're paid for our integrity. And those are the three mm-hmm. things that make up like a good thought worker. And I use that term a lot lately because I think that we're kind of in the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution, but for thought workers right now. And that's why I'm starting to just think more about like what makes a good thought worker. You know, if you really boil it down, I can't get it to any like lower level than those three elements, you know, enthusiasm, curiosity, and integrity.
Those are the things that AI can't have.
Yeah.
Woo. Okay. Let's shift. Love the deep note. And honestly, like I think you and I could have these conversations for hours. You were on the AI panel. So for anyone listening, there's a panel that we did on December 30th. It was pretty lightly attended, but it was a really fun panel to just sort of spitball back and forth what we think, where we think AI is going and productivity wise, which is when I got to meet David. Thankful for your network who introduced me to you because I didn't know you before that event. So it was a really great event. David shared some very strong opinions that I absolutely loved. So I would strongly recommend going to hub.builtfor.dev to find that recording. But coming back to the conversation, what is your, now that you've shifted away from sales engineering, site reliability engineer, what does your day-to-day look like? Obviously you're new, so I realize, you know, you're doing onboarding probably still, but you know, generally what does that type of a day look like?
We're startup. I was committing code the second day I was actually maybe first love day. It. Right now that. I am fully responsible for delivering a new service into, ooh, you know, our environments. So I'm working with the development team and, you know, QA engineers and, other folks on my team, but I'm kind of having to lead the charge. We're like many shops. We have a sort of legacy application, and then we're mm-hmm. building a lot of sort of new greenfield things around it. I work more with the greenfield things, but specifically with what I'm working on now, there's a lot of integration between the two. So, okay, cool. Sales engineer chops are coming in handy because I'm really having to like pull people together. You know, trying to kind of do a good job of that. But you know, my day-to-day, I think I use pretty strong developer ergonomics. You know, for me, my life is, you know, writing code, committing it to Git, you know, opening PRs, getting approval. I do a lot of, architecture is a strong word, but I do a lot of like thinking about how things could be maybe done a little bit better. There's a reactive element to it.
For sure.
I think, you know, anybody, and if you're a developer, like in your, you know, a little board as a back end developer, front end developer, like there's always a need for SREs and DevOps people, and the best or some of the best DevOps people are developers. Like if you can wrap your head around sort of, you know, I describe it as like, if the front end developers are like painting your house and making it beautiful and doing your window trim and all that sort of stuff, and maybe the back end developers are like laying down the floor and building your cabinets and putting up drywall, we're wiring things, we're putting in the plumbing, we're, you know, kind of behind the scenes, but still, you know, code. And it's a great job, and mm-hmm. you have to think a little bit differently to do the same thing. You know, I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense because I did some DevOps after being a developer. So I fully agree.
Yeah. And, but it's, you know, there's a lot of impact. There's a lot of autonomy. And I would say that the one bummer is like, I miss the succinctness of a feature. You don't really get that. A lot of long lived projects. It's hard to work in sprints. It's hard to like chop mm-hmm. things up into smaller tasks. You do end up with like, a lot of updates that are like still chugging along, like still working through issues, like, you know, something that you might think would take a week takes a month. I'm really struggling with that right now. Estimation and deadlines and things like that. Like, I feel like the more senior you get, the more you have to take responsibility for that. You don't have other people being like, you can definitely get this done in 2 weeks. Like, you're going to get this done in 2 weeks. It's like,
yep.
You know, I don't have anything, anyone to escalate to if I can't get it done in 2 weeks. So it does, yep. There's a lot of moving targets, but, you know, generally day to day, I'm working through what I'm working through. I'm interacting with my team, pretty collaborative, love to kind of mob on things, pair on things. And then, you know, I'm trying to make some time for career development right now. I was going to learn the Zig programming language this year, and I started on it. And then I was like, I want to just get really good at Golang. I've been writing Go for, mm-hmm. you know, 7 or 8 years intermittently. And so kind of made me just want to double down on that. So working on that, working on writing more, and you know, maybe figuring out how to share my story and, you know, maybe help some other people that want to work in tech or struggling with tech and imposter syndrome and all that sort of stuff. Cause I've done it.
Yeah. I really wish that there was like a support, like an online therapy support, not actual really therapy, but like just somewhere for developers to just come in if they have to be anonymous, because that's how they feel comfortable, but just somewhere to just come in, like sort of dump and engage, because it is so frequent that I meet other developers who are like, oh, it's so nice to hear your story. And not because my story is exciting, but because there's some relatability and we all feel imposter syndrome. Like when we think about it, doctors have like medical licenses and they have to stay on top of things, and medical boards tell them what to stay on top of things and what they're supposed to do. There is nothing for developers. They're just like, well, we're figuring it out ourselves. So we are constantly like filled with imposter syndrome because there is no bar at which that we can compare ourselves against you, except for our neighbors. But we're told not to compare ourselves to the Joneses, right? So yeah. How can we, by extension, ever feel satisfied if we don't know where that bar is like many other professions do? So that was my soapbox, but yeah.
No, I'm with you. There is a Slack channel that has been around for over a decade. That it's a little bit like, if you know, you know, but also like, those. You know, so I wouldn't broadcast it on here, but if someone's interested and pings me, I would be happy to share.
I'll ping you after.
Please. And it has a mental health channel, or it's a Slack group or a Slack account, but it has a mental health group that is probably the most active on the server. Like,
wow, I think that's beautiful.
It's a lot of people being like, I got a weird review. How do I make my work visible? How do I, like, you know, and it's, you know, directors at FAANG companies all the way down to, you know, how do I get my first job out of college? And you know, a lot of people are struggling with anxiety and depression. A lot of people are like, hey, has anyone ever tried this, you know, mental health drug, or has anyone ever tried like this type of therapy, or does anyone have any recommendations for therapy in this area? And there are things out there. I think that,
very true. There are probably,
we talked about empathy for a lot in DevOps. I feel like DevOps was just all about empathy. There's a precursor to empathy that is not, supported in most industries. And that is vulnerability. You cannot be empathetic to someone if you're not also vulnerable. And that is the thing that I've really struggled with in my personal life, my professional life, like, and everything in between. But now that I'm learning to be vulnerable, I'm finding that life's a lot easier. And you can, you know, if you're worried about a bad review or about a passive aggressive thing that a coworker said to you, it is okay to just ask them what they meant by that. And it's really great to just hop on a call and do it face to face, even if, you know, we lose a lot of that empathy and vulnerability just inherently in our sort of remote world, which is great. I don't want to go back to an office. It's not worth the trade-off for me, but
I will not go back to an office either.
Yeah. But I'm working on ways to sort of bridge that gap. And I think that, vulnerability is everything. And if you can just get to a place where you can find a supportive company that you can feel vulnerable in, that you can build empathy for people, you know, like I talked about before, the only actual currency in life is relationships. And those are the things that will make your job good. like, I don't want to work in a shop deploying C# applications to Azure, but if there was the most awesome people in the world there, I would do it every day with a smile on my face. Luckily, yeah. I work at a shop now with awesome people, and we're deploying tech that I like, and that's great. You can have it all, but
yeah,
the people are more important.
Yes, yes, yes. I think back to different teams and different places that I worked. I was most recently laid off from Snapchat, like almost a year ago now. In a couple weeks, it'll be a year. And I think the hardest part of that was the people. Like, whatever it is they're doing over there, smart, kind, and creative is their values. And people show up with all three of those values every day. And it is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in terms of coworkers. So sometimes it's like, I'm sad. And it's not that I'm sad, that I'm happy I'm doing my business. I'm happy I'm doing what I'm doing and getting to drive developer growth for multiple companies. But gosh, do I like miss the people, and I miss being on a team. I'm like so lonely. And so, and it's not, I have people, right? I have 4 kids. I'm married. I have people, but it's different when you're in that work setting and you're working with coworkers and you're hanging out. And I think of all the things I realized with doing this live stream, which just gives me more conviction to keep doing it and talk to awesome people like you, is that it's actually like taken away some of that loneliness. Like I've realized over the last few weeks, and I'm like, holy cow, I'm getting happier. Like each and every day I'm like happier, and I'm like, ah, my people, I need to hang out with my people, whether it's someone new I've never met, but people who are like us, right, who think this way. And then coming back around, I wanted to speak to what you had said about the mental health channel. And I think that being vulnerable is really hard. I am vulnerable enough to build strong relationships with people. And I know that because I'm very socially mature in that way, right? I know how to build relationships well. It's one of my superpowers. But I'm not vulnerable about the things that I really need to be vulnerable about. And I think when we think about things in like a mental health channel, like I don't know that I would dive into that, because I'm like, this is just, I just have crap, right? I just have problems. Like I just have stuff going on, right? And I wouldn't necessarily jump to that. But I think it's beautiful that there is a channel that is sort of normalizing, like, software engineering is hard. Tech is hard. We have no bar at which we are set to, right? So as far as we're concerned, we don't know when we are good and when we are not good. And I think that part is the hardest of all.
Yeah. Yeah. The stakes are high. Like you make a lot of money and you build a lifestyle and commitments around that money. And then you need to keep making that money. And then things change and you need to make more money. And that's a lot to sit with. I'm a single earner. My wife is a stay-at-home mom, and it's amazing and beautiful. And I wish that I could say we were doing it purely out of love, but childcare is so expensive that it really doesn't make sense for her to work, but that's a lot. It's a lot on me. And I used to really let my personal life affect my work a lot. And I used to use it as an excuse. But now I'm like, I'm finding it as an awesome respite, when I'm feeling stressed and anxious about, a weird fight that I have with my wife or whatever going on in my personal life, work is consistent. It's there. These people are working with me every day and we have shared goals, in whatever level of alignment we're in, like we're at least working towards the same things. And I'm starting to find a lot of comfort from that. And when that gets ripped away from you, by choice or otherwise, that's trauma. Like I think, our generation, we hop around a lot. Look at my LinkedIn. I struggle. I have struggled to find a home. And a lot of that has been,
I think that's tech though too. Give yourself grace there.
It is tech. I up until the last couple of years have been a pretty difficult personality type, very high conflict, very like when you're insecure and you're struggling with that imposter syndrome, you get really defensive really quickly. And people don't want to work with that. And so slowly things start to degrade and, you're like, wow, no one likes me here anymore. I should find a new job. And I don't want to keep doing that. And so that's why I've really just been trying to be really grateful for, have a lot of gratitude for the people that I work with, whether they are right, wrong, or indifferent about this, that, and the other, like at least they're there. At least like you have someone to talk to share this goal. And that's awesome. I've been freelance before, that sucks when you're just like, here's the thing, do the thing. And So yeah, I'm very much a, yeah, it's tough. It's tough. And, you know, there could be a future in which I build something on my own or with a small group of people. And one of the things that's always kept me away from sort of chasing that idea, as fleeting as it might be, is, can I do this on my own? Like, do I know what I'm doing enough to just take this on? And right now in my life where I'm at, like I'm loving being an employee. I've got a lot to learn. I feel like a lot of my career was running on ego for a long time. And now that I'm learning to be a little bit more vulnerable and get the ego out of the way, it's like, oh wow, I could actually learn something. I could legitimately be good at this and, like, you know, provide value to a company and not be a liability. That's a powerful feeling.
Oh, I love all the vulnerability that you just shared. Completely agree on childcare. We have four kids, but I have three of the four are in school, right? So we don't have care for them, but my husband's a stay-at-home dad. And so I know exactly what that's like. He's been a stay-at-home dad for the last 9 years, and it's, you sort of set your life up, right? And even when, and so this will be sort of a, I don't know, a little tip for your wife, maybe, like, to keep some form of passion or something that she loves doing, because now our 2-year-old is 2, right? And so he's just a little, he's crazy like a toddler, and he needs to go to daycare. Like, he needs to get out. He needs structure. We've just learned that his personality type needs it. And so my husband's like, okay, what do I go out and do now? I've been a stay-at-home dad for like 9 years. He's like, everything that I did know, like his technical skills, he used to do fiber ops and telecoms, has all sort of fleeted, right? Things are changing, advancing, and like, he's been out of the workforce. So I think it's an interesting dynamic of that stress, right? Of both being that stay-at-home parent and provider, because frankly, it's not a job I can do. Like, I cannot be a stay-at-home parent. It is not for me. I don't have the patience. I don't have that willpower. There's not I'm an achiever mentality or achiever sort of dimension in terms of personality. And so it's very hard to figure out how you win when you're taking care of children. So it just it doesn't work for me. But on the other side, there's all this stress, right? Of being the breadwinner and the sole provider. And if I get hit by a bus, like, what the heck happens to my kids? What happens to my family? Or even if I just lose my job, right? Then what happens? What do you do then? So, there's a lot with, you know, sort of that role generally and of being that sole provider, but also like doing that in technology, right? Where again, the ecosystem is just so different than what is out there in the rest of the world.
Yeah, no, for sure. Mm. Yeah, my son is 3, and he just started we live in the city of Chicago, and he started a preschool here that's thankfully a part of the parks department. Otherwise, like,
oh, I love that.
The preschools here are really expensive and pretty unobtainable, frankly.
That's sad. Well, education should be attainable. It's so frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it back when there was a middle class, things like that could happen, but you know, now it's
here we go.
Like, I talk about it a lot, but like, six-figure poverty, man, it's a real thing. Like, it's a real thing to be making what feels like a lot of money, and it's just gone as soon as you get it. And now that he's in a preschool situation, my wife is much like me. She's very autodidactic. If there's something she wants to do, she'll just do it. So she wrote a children's book and taught herself Photoshop and illustrated. She's an incredible artist and drawer and you know, visual artist in general, but she's just like, I'm gonna write a children's book, and she just did it. And it's like almost done. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So you know, like,
side note, I would love to buy it. Sorry not to interrupt you, but I would love to buy it. So hand it over when amazing. It's done.
Yeah, absolutely. Will do. I think you'll really like it. And yeah, so you know, like, grit we talked about earlier, and then like enthusiasm and all that sort of stuff. It's a family value for me, and it's a family value for us. So like, it's awesome having that alignment, but it's a lot of stress, you know, it's a lot of like,
yes, it is.
Like, it's just all on me. And you know, I don't have any generational wealth. I don't have same. Like, I don't have anything to fall back on. You know, this is it. I'm a pretty good cook. I have a couple of nice knives. So like, I could, you know, maybe go get a line cook job and keep the lights on if I really had to, work my way up to sous. And do that if I really had to, but that's it. I can write code and I can cook food and that's about it. I can play drums, but I've lost more money as a musician than I've ever made.
And that's so unfortunate, but
I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a lot. It's good to have other people that are like-minded and vulnerable and supportive. The leader at my job right now is amazing and fantastic, and has really taught me a lot already, and shares a lot of my values. And I think that for a long time, I got jobs that didn't align with my values because I was just like, whoever will hire me, that is where I will work. I'm being a little more selective now. And I have the luxury of that because I'm, you know, more senior in my career. But that is super important. Don't be unhappy at your job. I've done that too much, and it's not necessary.
What happens if you're making yourself unhappy? it's so hard in a business. It's hard because keep going.
If you're unhappy, you're always making yourself unhappy. That's something that I've learned. Like you, there's always a different direction that you can walk in. And I've kind of had to learn to accept that. You just have to accept responsibility for it. If you're making yourself unhappy, stop.
True that. High standards. It's hard when you own a business and you have high standards. But I think it comes back to sort of everything we've talked about in this conversation, the imposter syndrome, the childhood, the upbringing, right? The uneducation. I constantly feel imposter syndrome because I'm uneducated. But it's like I still have these beautiful, amazing skills that people want to pay for. And so I need to give myself grace is where it all comes down to. So,
yeah, you're not uneducated. You just don't have a formal education. But I mean,
so true.
I've worked with so many people that have elite degrees from elite schools, and they're like, yeah, you know, I learned a lot about Java garbage collection. And like, you know, I wrote a C compiler and assembler, but like, I don't know anything about API gateways and AWS or, you know, CloudFront. Like, and that's the reality of, you know, that's the reality of doing a lot of work. I mean, if you're a backend developer, it's like, yeah, they didn't teach me how to configure my Postman to go through an ngrok layer because we have to use, you know, like CloudFront in our local dev environments. You know, that's the sort of stuff that you learn on the job. Like, and it's so invaluable. And I think that like, yeah, there needs to be more like, we should all have like, if once you've been in tech for 10 years, you should just have like an honorary master's degree from the university of your choice.
Boom. I love that. I do love, and honestly, there's so much truth to that. Like, and we could even dive into that in a whole session about how much you learn by just being like thrown to the wolves, honestly, because that's actually really the best way, in my opinion, to learn something that's valuable to an employer. But there's a couple topics I like to talk about before we jump off, and we're nearing the end of our time together, unfortunately. I know that you do slightly different things than maybe a traditional developer or software engineer, but still doing a lot of the same technical overlaps and otherwise. So what does your like building stack look like? You talked about, you know, investing in Go and how you want to, you know, obviously become a stronger Golang, you know, Golang capable, right? But like what... what else is sort of in that stack of things you like to do? I'm going to jump there.
I mean, I'll start from my fingers and go to the metal.
Here we go.
Yeah. So I've been in editor purgatory for a little bit. I was a Vim guy for a long time. Mm. And then I used a sort of variant of Vim called Spacemax that was Vim running on top of Emacs. Then I got tired of all that and I used VS Code for, I don't know, 3-4 years. Yep. I've been playing around with Zed, which is a sort of native AI editor, but lighter weight than some of the other ones. And then recently I've been back in NeoVim. So weird full circle, but having a lot of fun in NeoVim right now, playing around, you know, customizing it with Lua and stuff. So, you know, use that. If someone was like, hey, I've got this great idea and, you know, $10 million and I want you to architect this from the ground up, depending on what it was, but, you know, let's just say it's sort of a standard web application where I'm going to need, you know, a backend, databases, queues, whatever, and maybe some sort of front end. So I would probably lean on Go for most of the backend stuff, or maybe just like TypeScript, Node.js, Express services or whatever for just the ease of finding people to help me, you know, like I love Elixir, but I'm not going to write something on, you know, Phoenix with Elixir because it would, you know, I there's 12 people that could help me, and I know six of them.
And they're all employed, I'm sure.
Yes. And then if there's anything sort of data intensive or something that I could use, like a DAG, TensorFlow, something like that, you know, obviously Python. It's hard to build anything in tech without Python making its way in one way or another. For sort of orchestration and all that, I do really lean heavily on Terraform, Kubernetes. I like Pulumi and, you know, CDK. I've played around with Crossplane. If it's infrastructure as code, like I typically, you know, I'm down with it. I would lean towards OpenTofu now, probably, as opposed to HashiCorp Terraform. Love HashiCorp, but, you know, times are changing and it just is what it is. And then, you know, I don't, it's funny. I'm actually, I want to take on like a front end freelance gig at some point this year just to do it. It's been a while, but for anything sort of website related, I'd probably go for like Jamstack, you know, Next.js. As sort of static as possible, probably use like a definitely static file deployments for all things front end. I actually have like a little bit of an affinity towards like front end DevOps, which people don't really think about that much. But you know, leaning on things like CDNs and static file deployments, building managed version artifacts for easy front end rollbacks and stuff like that. So I get excited about that sort of stuff. And I think that's a pretty like standard stack. You know, you could really drop anything in its place. Like if I had a good reason to use Rust, cool. Let's do it in Rust. I wouldn't really lean for any kind of legacy. Like I really wouldn't want to have to deal with an ORM or MVC framework or anything like that. And then I would try to do everything as cloud native as possible. You know, like I feel like AWS is just kind of where we end up most of the time. So I'd really leverage things like SQS, SNS, managed Redis, managed databases, all that sort of stuff. And I don't really have strong opinions on like Postgres versus MySQL or Redis versus whatever faster thing or Kafka versus this or that or the other, like best tool for the job.
Yep.
But that's sort of my like 100 yard view of my tech stack. I like Spotify a lot. That's pretty important in my
Gotta have the vibes. Yeah. Oh, I love that. You were very comprehensive in your response. And it's usually like, oh, I use this IDE or I use whatever. And it's pretty pretty summarized. But that was very verbose on the tech stack that you enjoy, which I love hearing because like for me, you know, coming back to like not being as technical most recently, that was one of the core reasons of starting the show. One of them was because I have to market my business and I hate marketing my own stuff. Love marketing for other developer products, not my own. But starting the show, I was like, hey, if I can chat with developers every day, then I can start to learn what are the technologies they care about? Why do they care about them? Why are they so opinionated about it? And then allow that to flow into like my trends and opinions as I'm getting back into, you know, building things myself. So
yeah. Totally.
Okay.
Totally.
Yeah. Last question. And then we will wrap up because we are already over, as long as that's okay. Are you okay on time?
Fine. I'm good.
Okay. Cool. Cool. What do you do when you're stuck? loaded question. I know, but
yeah. You know, a year ago I'd say ask ChatGPT, but me and ChatGPT have probably been going at it quite a bit at this point already. Cause it's
I can relate to that.
Pretty big part of my workflow and yeah, that's a whole other episode. I ask for help always. I try to ask for help before I'm stuck.
I love that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what are your signals when you think you're going to get stuck? Cause that is the first time I've heard that answer, is that you try to avoid getting stuck to begin with. So I'd love for you to double tap into that.
I mean, we all know the feeling of like uncharted waters when you're like in a place and you're like, I'm making it up as I go along right now. And then when you feel that friction of like, yeah, I'm not doing a great job of making it up as I go along right now. That's when you just bring someone into sanity check. They might not know either, but they could at least come at it, you know, with a different lived experience. And I think that, that is where the ego struggles. It's cause like asking someone for help that doesn't know any better how to do it than you do is a really difficult thing to do sometimes, but it is so powerful The only thing better than one person who doesn't know what they're doing is two people that don't know what they're doing. And if you can add a third, it gets even better. And eventually, the result of three people who don't know what they're doing trying to figure it out often results in three people who know what they're doing and just learn something.
Ooh. Yes. I love that. That was a beautiful answer. Like, best answer yet, I think. I've gotten a lot of chat GPTs. I go to my peers, go to my mentors, Stack Overflow, GitHub, search the internet, you know, AI, just sort of all the things. But like that, I think is something that, especially early in your career, is incredibly hard to do, to like let that ego go and be like, hey, can you help me? But I think, like you said, that is the biggest learning opportunity. I also had some of an ego around that. I think because I was self-taught, it wasn't natural for me to have an ego generally, although I do like to win, but it's usually egoless. But I think the self-taught side of it made me feel constantly incapable, right? And so being able to be vulnerable, just like you said, and just be like, hey, how would you do this, right? Like, it doesn't have to be that you don't know how to do something. It's more of like, again, we don't have a bar that we are set to. So it's okay to be like, how would you think about this? How would you work on this? Because we're all just learning.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing is just reminding yourself that you already won. Like, you're here. You're getting to solve these problems and work with people that you respect and that you want to learn from. And it's just so incredible to be here. And if you can get that in your head, then everything else just feels a little less important.
You know what? That is so true. And just for context for you, because I know that oftentimes, especially people like you and I, we really like to help one another. That statement actually really helped me, because I've been struggling my business because I feel like there's this bar at which I need to reach, right? Where I've got this revenue flow and things are reliable. And honestly, the fact that I'm still getting to run my business almost a year later and like, yes, things are getting sketchy here, but I think that it's going to be okay. And that statement really just reminded me, like, I've always wanted to do what I'm doing right now. And so I need to just appreciate that I'm getting to do what I'm doing right now.
Same. I get to sit in my office with my skateboards on the wall and my music and, you know, drink Spindrift and play around with code all day. It's pretty amazing.
We are living the dream, David. Living the dream. Mm-hmm. Okay. I so much have enjoyed talking to you. We are definitely going to have to chat again. Where can people find you so that they can get all the amazing David essence for themselves as well?
Yeah. I think LinkedIn is a great place to find me, and I'm pretty findable. I think it's just D. Beal Jr. And then I have a website, which is just beal.sh, and it is not much, but it has links to things like Instagram and LinkedIn and my email address and things like that. You know, if anything that I've said resonates and you want to talk, like, I love talking. I love connecting with people, you know, whether in person or virtually or however. So, you know, please reach out. My network is your network. Like, we're all in this together.
Yes. Oh, I love that so much. Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, David. This has been an amazing session, honestly. And I really, really appreciate you.
Absolutely. I appreciate you too. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, friends. Well, have a fabulous rest of your Thursday. I have a girly hair appointment tomorrow, so there will be no 99 dev problems tomorrow, but I will see you all on Monday. Bye, everyone.